This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Hi and welcome to the Alcoholics Anonymous radio show here on Plains FM 96.9. My name is Kerry and I'm an alcoholic. The purpose of this show is to increase public awareness of Alcoholics Anonymous as an effective means of recovery from the disease of alcoholism. Our show has two parts. First, we'll talk a bit about alcoholism, what it is and what AA can do to help. And then we'll interview a recovering alcoholic who is an active member of AA. I'm now going to ask our guest to read the AA preamble, which is read at the start of every AA meeting.
Hi, my name's Tolmie and I'm an alcoholic. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
So what is alcoholism? Alcoholism is a disease, not a disgrace. There's no shame in having an illness or a disease. An unusual feature of this disease is that it will do whatever it can to convince you that you do not have it. However, once it has a hold of you, the progression of symptoms is like the classic disease model and the victim is as helpless as a sufferer of cancer. If you are an alcoholic, you are at the beginning of a long road that usually ends in one of three places: prisons, institutions or death. If you think this sounds dramatic, we can assure you that our collective experience has shown this to be true. The challenge is to convince the alcoholic to admit that they need help and become willing to seek it. Denial is a major symptom of alcoholism. The alcoholic is often the last one to recognise it and admit that they have it. Our definition of alcoholism is that it is an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. The allergy is a physical aspect of the disease. After having the first drink, the phenomenon of craving develops and we lose control over when we will stop drinking. The old saying is one is too many and a thousand is never enough. And yet, because of the obsession of the mind, the mental aspect of the disease, the alcoholic is compelled to keep picking up the first drink. This makes us powerless. We often hear from sober alcoholics that many doubted whether life could be fun without alcohol. Fortunately, those same people report that their lives have improved dramatically since they became sober. The 12-step program of recovery, which is discussed at meetings and which is outlined in the Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book, is how we get sober and maintain our sobriety one day at a time. This program has a proven track record of helping otherwise hopeless alcoholics to achieve long-term sobriety and recovery. It has taught us how to enjoy life sober. Okay, for anyone who has just joined us, you're listening to the Alcoholics Anonymous radio show here on Plains FM 96.9. This is a special version of our radio show. Rather than do our usual 30 minutes, this will be an hour and a half. So grab a cuppa and put your feet up. You're going to be here for a while because Bob D is going to have a bit of a yarn with us. This is Bob D's talk on the 16th of October in St. Joseph's Catholic Church here in Christchurch, New Zealand. A big thank you to Christchurch City Steps and Christchurch Tuesday Night Big Book Study for putting this on. Bob D, a little bit of background information about Bob D. He's from Las Vegas, Nevada, is a member of the Connect the Dots group in Las Vegas, which holds four meetings a week and takes panels of speakers into institutions. He is a regular circuit speaker both in the United States and internationally and is renowned for his insightful talks on the steps and traditions and topics such as surrender. He has been sober since 31st October 1978. So now we're going to hear Bob D. Take it away, Bob.
I'm Bob Darrow. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sober only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book entitled Alcoholics Anonymous. The ability to remain sponsorable in a persistent and consistent effort in our primary purpose of trying to set ourselves aside, forget ourselves, and devote our lives to helping others like us. And consequently, I've not had a drink or any mind for emotion-altering medication since October 31st, 1978. And that is the great miracle in my life. I'm delighted to be here. I want to thank whoever's involved with me being here, besides God, for being here. I'm just curious, if you'd indulge me, and I don't want to, I'm not asking this to put anybody in the spot, but how many people here are within their first year of absolute abstinence this time? Wow, welcome, glad you're here. How about anyone in your first 30 days? Wow, I'm really glad you're here. Anybody that's kind of fed up with all of us and you're already planned to be in your last 30 days? Hell of these people, I'm back. Because I would identify with that guy too. Because I was a relapser in Alcoholics Anonymous for a lot of years, about 7 years, throughout the early 70s. And I know what it's like to come back into the rooms and raise your hand again and just feel demoralized and feel ashamed of yourself. I did that over and over and over and over again. I get a disease called alcoholism, and it seems to come out of my very being. It wasn't done to me. And I remember I worked as a therapist back in the 70s for a little bit, because I was under an illusion that if I had knowledge, I would have gained enough power to overcome these problems, but that didn't happen. But in that time, it was very popular to try to blame your alcoholism on the way you were raised, right? And you'd hear people in AA speak, and they would tell you these horrible childhood stories as if that was why they were so messed up. Well, I used to be envious of people who had horrible childhoods because they had a reason that they were screwed up. I came from a family where that was burdened with love. I mean, my parents were wonderful people. My mother was a therapist. My dad was a legendary environmentalist. They were active members of the community. They loved us. My sister and I could see and intellectually understand and notice the love in our family. But even as a little kid, I couldn't feel it. I couldn't feel it. I was so internally focused and self-focused that I was that disconnected from my life itself, because I didn't live out here in the world where the love was and the people where I lived up here inside myself. And I didn't know it. All I knew is that I just didn't feel like other people looked. There was an awkwardness about me. And this family I came from, it was a great childhood. I mean, amazing, really, truly. And we did a lot of things together. I remember One day I was with my family, my mom and dad, we were out on an outing to some historical monuments and things. My dad loved to take us there, try to spoon feed us a little history, you know, little things that, you know, nice. And I'm just a little kid, I'm like preschool, toddler, maybe three, four. And we're on our way back home, and my dad wants to stop at this farmer's market. Now, I grew up in Pennsylvania, there were these farmer's markets outside of town where all the farmers would bring all the produce and their all the stuff that they produced, and they'd sell it in these little booths, and it was like fresh, great quality. We used to go to those places a lot. And my dad's going in, taking us into this farmer's market because he wants to buy this horseradish that he'd heard about that was supposedly really hot and really spicy and powerful. And he loved things like that. I remember watching him as a little kid. He would eat a whole bowl of those hot jalapeno peppers, you know, the ones that, and he'd eat them until his eyes would glaze over, and sweat would be pouring off his forehead, and he'd make a noise like he was having sex or something, you know, like, well, I think that was his alcohol, because alcohol to him didn't mean anything. It was something you'd have one or two glasses of in a long social evening. He didn't have what I had. But he loved that hot, spicy stuff. And I'm this little kid tagging along, and I'm hearing him brag to my mom about how amazing this horseradish is. And I want some. I said, "Papa, can I have some of that?" And he said, "Oh, no, Rob, you can't have that. That's too strong. That's only for adults. You can't have that." Now, I'm a funny kind of guy. I may not really want something until you tell me I can. You know what I mean? I'm just wired that way. To this day, it's difficult for me to walk by a do not touch wet paint sign without going like that. You know what I'm saying? I'm just a contrarian by nature. You think it's glow? No, it's not. It's red. You know, I'm that kind of guy. So I waited till my parents weren't around. I snuck in that kitchen, got that refrigerator open, got that jar of horseradish, got a big spoon. Stuck that spoon in that horseradish and stuck it in my mouth. And I saw God that morning. I spit that horseradish around that kitchen, threw that jar up against the wall. Snot's pouring out of my nose. Tears are coming out of my eyes. That was awful. It was so painful. Then all these decades later, I have not once sat with a jar of horseradish and a big spoon, didn't need no horseradish sponsor, no horseradish steps, no horseradish meetings, nothing. But if you're new, I want you to hear this. If that horseradish would have done for me what alcohol did for me, I'd have made myself sick with that crap every chance I could get. Because I was born with an incompleteness. I was born with that thing, it's that thirst, that hunger, that yearning that seems to be part and parcel of all of us, that all of us can't get enough of anything, people. An alcoholic can take a 6-month supply of something good and use it up in about 2 weeks. Because I'm a not enough guy, right? I've always been a not enough guy. But I don't know it. And I'm a kid, and I ain't right. And I don't want anybody to know how not right I am, because I'm so afraid of what you think of me. And I'm afraid a lot. I'm not tough, but I try to act like it, because it's a thing to do with the guys I hang around with. I don't belong anywhere. There's something wrong with me, and I don't know what it is. And so what happens is I become the pretend guy. I become the guy who pretends he's not afraid. I become the guy who pretends he's tough. I become the guy who pretends he fits. The guy who pretends he's cool. The guy who pretends he's all right. And the truth is, I'm none of that. And I was doing what it talks about in chapter into action before I ever picked up a drink. I was leading the double life that it talks about in our book. I was creating a stage character and then cowering behind the character with an anxiousness that someone's going to find out. Someone's going to see through this facade what a worthless, pathetic, weak, afraid, not fitting kind of guy I am. See, I'm all front and no back. And I live behind the facade. And something happened to me when I was almost 13 years old that, unbeknownst to me, would literally change the course of my life. And I'm hanging around with a bunch of older kids, and I wanted to fit with these kids. My God, I just wanted what they had. These were the kids that were in and out of juvenile detention all the time. These were the kids that when they walked into a junior high dance, the other kids got out of the way. Right? These were the tough kids. The one guy was a legend. He punched out a teacher. Oh my God. I mean, I want to be the guy who walks in and makes people afraid, because I'm tired of being the guy who's afraid all the time. And I'm one who thinks if I can hang out with them and do what they do, maybe some of their something is going to rub off on some of my nothing. Right? So I'm trying, I'm stealing, I'm cursing, I'm fighting, I'm doing it, I'm smoking cigarettes, I'm doing everything they do because I just want to feel like they look. But those of us that have played that game, you know, you never really quite get there, do you? You never really can feel like they look. Until a day came where we broke into a house in the town we lived in. And one of the things we stole out of that house was some bottles of whiskey. And I didn't know nothing about whiskey. I don't think I knew what got you drunk. I'd never seen anybody drunk. I mean, my whole childhood never were drunk. I saw them have one drink occasionally. But, you know, they don't know how to drink. You know, they're the kind of people that they'll sip a drink for 20, 30, 40 minutes. You know, you watch the ice melt. You know, it's horrible. Alcohol abuse in my book. So I don't even know that alcohol gets you high. I don't even know that. But I wanted to fit with these guys, so they're passing this bottle of whiskey around, and whatever they're doing, I'm doing. You know what I'm saying? And they passed the bottle to me, and nobody said nothing about the burning. And I took a big hit off that bottle of whiskey, because the other kids, the guys that took the bigger hits, got the most attention and kind of attaboys from the other kids, right? So when it comes to me, I'm in. I'm going to take a big hit. I'm just glad it wasn't cat urine, because I'm in. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to take a big hit off that bottle. And I did it. Oh my God, I thought it was like sulfuric acid or something. It just burnt my insides. But when the burning stopped, something started to happen to me that had never happened to me before. You know, you don't really know how that you don't really feel good until you really start to feel good. And I love what happened to me when I drank alcohol. All of a sudden, I don't have to pretend I'm somebody with these guys. My God, in no time at all, I was their leader. It was amazing. I could come out and play. I was free. Whatever that thing is that's been on me has gotten off of me. And I could be funny. I'm not funny sober. I'm a depressive mope, for God's sake. You get me half drunk, I crack me up. I'm funny. I love the effect of alcohol. I used to hang out with these, we all hung out at this pool room with a bunch of other juvenile delinquents. I'd get down there, I'd be drinking, and I'd get in that zone. There's a place where you're drunk, but not drunk yet. You know, just you cut, and things click. And I could shoot pool, I'm telling you, better than I could ever shoot pool. A year or two later, I started playing music. I could sing and play guitar in front of people on a stage. I couldn't do that sober. They're all looking at me. I can dance. I can't dance sober. You get me half drunk, the rhythm of the universe flows. It's amazing. I could be so intelligent and deep. Maybe somebody had this experience, like smoking reefer, drinking wine, about 3 a.m. and you're starting to see the big picture. You know what I mean? I say things to my buddies, this is what Buddha saw. You know what I mean? This is amazing. I'm blowing my own mind, right? And then I sober up and I'm back to being me again. And I never liked that much. And that was my big secret. My big secret is once I found the amazing effect of alcohol, without it I felt like I was nothing. Without it, it just seemed like I was doing time till the next time I could get free. And I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I started getting in trouble. You know, I don't know that I have alcoholism, but I got alcoholism. And if you have alcoholism, alcohol does something for you and does something to you that it doesn't do to neurotics, drug addicts, all kinds of other people. It only does these two things for the alcoholic. And the one thing it does for me is it sets me free. It is the most immediate and the most effective medicine for this bondage of self that I've ever discovered. Because I'll tell you how I am sober. I'm sober and I just got myself right up on me. Like, do you ever see that movie Alien, that creature attaches itself to his face? Right? I just get meat on me until I feel like I'm smothering here. Like I'm suffocating, and I am. I'm suffocating my very soul with me and my problems and my anxieties and my future and my remorse. I just get me right up on me, and I feel stuck up inside of me. And then I drink alcohol and I get free. And I can come out and play. Alcohol even gave me levels of intimacy that I didn't even know existed. Because self-centered people like myself, when we're sober, we don't fit anywhere. I don't belong out here with you. I don't fit out here with you, because the truth is I don't live out here with you. I live up here with me. Separate and apart from. In a state of lonely and painful separation. But I don't know that. All I know is when I'm not drinking, I don't feel that great. I don't feel very good. And alcohol did something for me that was so spectacular, it set me free. And as the disease progresses, there's a diminishment of that return. And I'll talk about that a little later. But then alcohol does something to me. And it only does this to people with alcoholism. I remember at the end of, in the U.S., the end of the Vietnam War, we had literally thousands of people coming back from Southeast Asia with mega heroin addictions. Some of them had what I got. Some of them were alcoholic and just happened to get drug addicted. But some of them weren't. I have friends that, you know, 40 years later, they have one or two beers once in a while. And it doesn't set them off. They're not compelled to get drunk. They're not compelled to get heroin. It's they do not have what I have. See, when I drink alcohol, something happens to me. As the effect of the alcohol hits me, I break out in this irresistible yearning for more. I was 10 years sober, and I was sitting in a meeting and listening to a speaker talk about something that I've heard many times in AA, about being a social drinker for a number of years, and then seeming to cross over a line into alcoholism. And I went home that night and I started thinking, was I ever a social drinker? I mean, you know, I must have been somewhere. I mean, you know, it made perfect sense. You had to be, I couldn't imagine I was just born an alcoholic. I had to drink myself into it or something. And I'm looking for one instance, that's just one, I'm not looking for a lot, just one day too, where I've been drinking at the bar, maybe shooting pool with my buddies, doing shots and beers for an hour, and had one of my friends named Bob. Hey, can I buy you another one, Bob? I'm looking for the time where I thought to myself as they said that and offered me another drink, the time I thought, no, you know I'm good here. I can't find, you think you can find one or two instances like that, but I came out of, if I was ever a social drinker, it was the first 5 seconds when I first started drinking. Because when that effect of that alcohol hit me, it owned me. It owned me. The problem is, I have this phenomenon of craving, this allergic reaction to alcohol, and I can't see it. I think there every single day, hundreds of us die from this disease, and we don't see what's killing us. Because you can't see the phenomenon of craving. And it's because of, like all cravings, you don't realize that you're in the grip of it as long as you're satisfying it. Everyone in this room at this moment is in the grip of a craving you're not aware of. That's the craving to breathe air. But if the person sitting behind you slipped a plastic bag over your head and pulled it tight, you'd instantly realize you have a craving to breathe air because you can't satisfy it. Well, it was hard for me to see the phenomenon of craving because I just intuitively avoided situations where I was only going to get a couple drinks and couldn't get any more. I remember junior high school, going over to a buddy's house Sunday afternoon. You can't buy alcohol on Sundays in the state I live in. And there's three of us there, and he had a six-pack for the day. I was so generous, I said, oh, no, thank you. You guys help yourself. And I don't say that because I think I'm an alcoholic. I did the math. The best I'm going to get is three. out of maybe four if I drink really quick, and I like to drink quick. If I drink, I'll get three or four out of that six pack, and then what? Mm-hmm. And then what? Mm-hmm. Right? And then what? And so I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am not an alcoholic, and I don't have that phenomenon of craving. This was somewhere in the early, mid-70s, and a woman in AA told her part of her story about how she'd been sober for several months and went to a dinner party and had a glass of wine, and then she talked about what happened to her when she had that glass of wine. And as she told the story, I remembered something that had happened to me when I was 18 years old. Now, I want you to understand, when I was 18 years old, you could have put me on a lie detector and said, Bob, is there any way in the world you're alcoholic? I would have said, absolutely not. And I bet you it would have said I was telling the truth. Now, I might have admitted that I had a problem with drugs because I was going through my better living through chemistry phase of my alcoholism. You know, the flag I marched under was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, or at least two of those, and hopefully a third. But I don't think I'm an alcoholic. In the book, it says, the beginning of chapter 3, it says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. That's a universal. It's universal in the world. We go to great lengths. I'll be a drug addict. I'm willing to do that. I mean, drug addicts, there were rock stars that were drug addicts. They had a lot of panache. They were kind of cool. I'm good with that. I'll be a drug addict. I'll be a mental health case, because if you're a mental health case, you get pills and sympathy. I like both of them. But I don't want to be an alcoholic. I had uncles that were alcoholics. I don't know what it was to be an alcoholic, but I know everybody in the family talked crap about it. And I knew that they were difficult to be around. And they were just uptight. And they were obnoxious. And I just thought, I'm not going to be like that. I'll be anything, but I ain't going to be no alcoholic. But I have alcoholism, and people who argue with the truth get sick. And I'm dating this girl, and she invites me over to her family's house and to have dinner with her family, her mom and dad. I go over, and we sit down at the dinner table. They bring out a bottle of wine. Not the kind of bottle of wine I'd have bought. This was like, this is a little wimpy Al-Anon. You know what I mean? This is one of those low, this bottle of wine has a cork. Don't trust bottles of wine that have corks. It was probably 11% alcohol. I like stuff that's 20% alcohol. I like stuff that if you read the label, it says things like, grape flavoring and neutral grain spirits. I like wine that hasn't been 50 miles near a grape. You know what I'm saying? But it'll take you downtown now. This isn't that kind of wine. It's like Blue Nun or some crappy Al-Anon kind of wine. Now we sit down at the dinner table. I'm not an alcoholic. You guys would have sworn I'm not an alcoholic. And they pour us all a glass, and I drink quickly. I don't know what that's about. Maybe evaporation is some secret child relationship. Because I drink quickly, I've killed two glasses out of that bottle of wine. They're still sipping on their first glass. And the bottle's dead. And I'm looking at that bottle, and I'm getting a little uncomfortable here. I don't know nothing about alcoholism or phenomenon of craving or any of that. But I started noticing that the conversation at the dinner table that earlier had been okay was starting to seem stupid and tedious. You know what I mean? But I don't say anything. I just sit there and try to smile. And I finally blurted it out. I said, God, that was good wine. Do you have any more? And they said, no, we don't have any more. And they went back to talking about sports and Vietnam and movies and crap. And I'm sitting there and two glasses of wine in me. I finally blurted it out. I said, I like beer. They said, we don't have any beer, Bob. Next time you come over, we'll get a six-pack of beer. And they went back to talking. And I'm sitting there, and I feel like I'm losing my mind. And I finally excused myself. I went to their bathroom. I locked the door, and like a frantic, crazy person, went through all their cabinets, and I found this bottle of cough medicine, unopened, 35% alcohol with codeine and terpene hydrate, which is a plus. And I sat on the edge of their bathtub, and chugged that bottle of cough medicine, all that irritable angst inside me just went. I was able to think clearly. And I was able to come up with a story. I went back out to that dinner table and I explained to them about something that I had forgotten to take care of tonight. And I was sad to leave. And they were very sad to see me go. And I said, well, come and do this again. And I went out and I got my car, which was parked right in front of their house. And I drove down to the street 25, 30 miles an hour like you're supposed to, suburban area. And then I drove 75, 80 miles an hour through suburban back streets to get to my friend Brett's house, because Brett had some tie stick and a bar in his basement. And I did all of that because of two glasses of wine. And I think every one of us has to find those instances, those rare instances, where the craving hit us and it changed our whole perception and our whole way we showed up, we sat in the world. There's a test in the big book, it's self-diagnosis, it's in chapter 3. I think it's a good test. I recommend it to some guys, because I do a lot of meetings. I take panels into three a week into these treatment centers. We get a lot of guys, especially today, there's a big opium epidemic in the U.S. Opioid, they call it. Mm-hmm. They're opioid addicts. Mm-hmm. We were just junkies. They're opioid addicts. And so I meet a lot of guys that don't think they're alcoholic, right? So, well, you know, look at chapter 3, second page, chapter 3. It says, you don't think you're an alcoholic? Okay, here. Quickly, you can quickly diagnose yourself. Mm-hmm. Go over to the nearest bar room. Try some controlled drinking. Drink and then stop abruptly. The book says you might need to do that several times to get a full knowledge of your condition, which is good stuff. Because what if you found out that you could take two drinks and it didn't set you off? What if you found out that you're like my daughter who can have two drinks and never go any further because that's enough for her? I mean, that's good information. Maybe your daughter will get married. You could go have a glass of champagne at her wedding. Because in Alcoholics Anonymous, this is not a temperance movement. Mm-hmm. We're not fighting alcohol. We're fighting something worse. Mm-hmm. We're fighting alcoholism. It's alcoholism that kills alcoholics. It's not alcohol. Alcohol may be the vehicle, mm-hmm. but it may be a gun. It may be a drug overdose. Mm-hmm. It may be jumping off a bridge, as I tried to do in 1978. Alcoholism kills alcoholics, not alcohol. My problem doesn't come in bags and bottles, it comes in people. Mm-hmm. It comes within me. And so, or you may do it, maybe you're like me. Maybe the test will try to shine a light in something, but because of your alcoholic mind, you won't see it. Maybe you haven't defended alcoholism as I did. An alcoholism that uses everything in your mind not to see the truth. Maybe you're recovery resistant, as I was. And if you are, and you go to take the test, well, here's what happened to me. I just came out of treatment. I think there's people in AA are full of crap. I got some problems. I got emotional problems. I'm a depressive. I've been diagnosed clinically depressive. I'm a depressive. I've done a lot of drugs. Then I drink. I get in some trouble drinking. But I don't have that phenomenon of craving. I'm not an alcoholic. So I'm going to go find out. I'm going to go down and do what these stupid people in AA said. I'm going to go into this bar, and I'm going to have two drinks. And since I'm only going to have two, I mean, two doubles. I'm going to have two doubles. Well, I'm only going to have two, for God's sake. I'm going to have two doubles. And then I'm going to shut her down and go home. Now, you can't smoke nothing. You can't go buy drugs. You can't switch to beer. Two drinks, that's it. Well, if you have the mind that I have, when you finish up that first drink, all of a sudden, you realize that this is a bad test day. This is not a good test day. That game's on. I didn't know that game was on. Now, I could have a drink. Well, I got to watch the rest of that game. Or some girl would come in, I think, oh my God, she's my soulmate. I could have a drink with her. Joe would walk in. Joe's got some good stuff to smoke. Better have a drink with Joe. Maybe he'll turn me on to a couple joints. Bad test day. Tomorrow's a better test day. I'll take the test tomorrow. And if you got the mind that I got, it used is the craving hits you, it uses your own mind against you, and it doesn't look to me, and it never looks to any of us, like we're in the grip of an allergic reaction to alcohol. It looks like I just changed my mind. It looks like I just got more information here. It looks like it's my idea. And that's the way this disease punks me out and burns my life to the ground over and over and over again, and I don't get what's happening to me. And I start feeling ashamed of myself. I start feeling that there's something really wrong with me. I start, like, sometimes sobbing, thinking, Bob, what's wrong with you? Why do you keep doing this to yourself? My parents are saying the same things to each other and to themselves. Everybody who ever cares about me is anguished over what's happening in my life. And none of us understand it. Because it looks to me like I must have some... My mother was a therapist. She sent me to some great psychiatrists because she believed from my behavior that I must have a self-destructive complex. It looked that way. Because just about the time I'd be back on my feet and I'm doing really good and everybody's starting to breathe easy around Bob. He's got a nice girlfriend. He's got a good job. Everybody thinks Bob's turned the corner. This is great. That's the time when I burn my frickin' life to the ground. And when it says in our book that we are a baffled lot, not only am I baffled by this thing, but everybody who loved me was baffled by it. And I didn't understand it. And what is it about this disease that keeps drawing me back to drinking like a moth to a flame? Even after, maybe it's your first time and you're not sure. But maybe this is your fifth time. And you know now. You know that every time you take one drink, the same thing happens. This is not your first rodeo. You get it. And maybe you're starting to swear to yourself and really mean it. Maybe you're swearing to yourself sometimes sobbing uncontrollably with tears of sincerity. And you're saying, I'll never touch that stuff again. And you'll meet it with everything in you. And then the insanity is 7, 8 weeks sometimes later, you're back at it again. Do that for a few years and see how you feel about yourself. Right? And I didn't know what was doing to me. I didn't know what was happening to me. It made no sense to me. Because I have a lot of willpower in a lot of different areas. But when I make up my mind to not drink, and I know I have the knowledge, surely I should be able to not drink. I mean, I really mean it. But I always go back to it. Because there's an aspect of this disease that makes this deadly. If you're chronic, and I'm a chronic alcoholic. And what does that mean? It means that my problem starts where the bottle ends. It's not just that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. There's something worse going on, and I can't see it. I have an abnormal reaction to abstinence. And it works on me. And I get sober with great hope. And I get sober sometimes with enthusiasm of what I've got. All right, I've learned my lesson. I'm gonna finish college. I'm gonna get a good job. I'm gonna get a girlfriend. Maybe I'll be a doctor. I'm gonna be a doctor. I'm gonna be a lawyer. I'm like one of those cars that don't turn over. Right? But I don't understand that lack of power is my dilemma. That this thing that's going to start happening to me is more powerful than my best and strongest intentions. And what is it that happens to me in this abnormal reaction to alcohol? Well, Silkworth probably says it the best, I guess. He said he talks about guys like me when we're sober. And he said we become restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless we can again experience that sense of ease and comfort that I once found in taking a few drinks. drinks which I see everyone in the world take with the impunity, without punishment. What does that mean? Well, that means I'm just getting out of the treatment center and I have high hopes for my life. I've learned my lesson. I'm never going to touch that stuff again. I'm going to do something with my life. I'm tired of being a loser. I'm going to do something with my life. I mean, for God's sakes, I was accepted at Ivy League colleges. I had the highest SAT scores in my whole private school. I have potential. And I feel like the world should look out because I'm about to unleash my potential. Well, I can't seem to find my potential. What I find is these squirmy little vague feelings after a while. This restlessness that I just can't get settled anywhere. I live in a world where everybody appears reasonably comfortable most of the time, and then there's me. I'm irritable. I can't even admit to myself I'm irritable. I don't want to be irritable. Irritable people irritate me. I'm not irritable. But I do have this ability to see stupid people a lot. Everywhere I look, I see stupid people. I see them in AA. I see them in church. I see them at work. I see them in traffic. I see them in the grocery store. She's buying a gallon of ice cream and a six-pack of Diet Coke. These are stupid people in the grocery store. And probably the one place where they have all the stupid people grouped is Alcoholics Anonymous. AA was intellectually offensive to me. You know, all this happy, clappy crap, you know, stop it. People say, they say their name and that whole room goes, "Hi, Bob." Stop it. This is dumb. This is like, this is worse than Amway. This is like bad. This is like bad. Jesus. Oh, and everybody's grateful for everything. The truth is, I don't like anything. It's not even I don't like myself, I loathe myself. Truly. Of course I do. If someone else would have done to my loved ones and my family and my life what I did to it, I'd want to kill them. Of course I secretly loathe myself. Sweep it under the rug. But it never goes very far. And all these people in AA are so grateful for everything. I remember sitting in a recovery house. I just burnt my leg to the ground. And I'm depressed and lonely. And I feel horrible. And I'm so full of shame and remorse. And these do-gooders in AA just come in and just tell me how wonderful their life is. I remember thinking, I've died and gone to hell. It's not bad enough that I ruined my life and hurt everybody I care about. Is that I'm going to have to sit somewhere and have stupid people tell me how better they are than I am and how wonderful their life is. I thought, this is hell. And you know, people hang out so all the time. They love everybody. It's so weird. You know, this love, 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 love. If you knew, we want you to know we love you. You ever been depressed and have somebody in AA come up to you and look you right in the eye and go, "Has anyone told you they loved you today?" Oh, man, shoot me, would you? Oh, my God, I don't know what the answer is, but you know a hug's coming. I don't want to overtouch you. Don't touch me. Oh, God. Oh. And then, God, everything. God's, jeez. I'm an atheist when I get here. Kind of. I'd like to be an atheist. But what I've known some real atheists. You have to be very religious about your atheism. What I really am is I'm a guy who's really afraid of the whole idea of God. I know something. I can't put it into words, but I know what I feel it with every ounce of my being, that if if, I hoping there's not, but if there was a God, I'm too stained for him. I'm too bad. I'm just too bad at being good and too good at being bad. I can be good for a little bit. And then it's like I outgood myself or something. And my efforts at being good seems to put torque on my bad, because when I stop being good, I get really bad. And I just know there's not a God. There can't be. It's a lose-lose situation. I'll never merit that. I'll never be good enough. I don't care what you say. You do good as an egg, and oh, your God loves you. Yeah, he loves you, maybe. You don't know what I've done. I've destroyed some people. He might help you if there was a God, but he ain't going to help me. I knew that in the very core of what I was. I was unworthy. So I'm the kind of guy, if I just suspect you don't like me, I'm going to not like you first. And I threw God out. And I tried to have that position that he didn't exist. But our book says deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And you can rage against it. You can have all kinds of intellectual arguments. But it doesn't change nothing. Somewhere deep down within me is a yearning for something. Carl Jung, in a letter to Bill Wilson in the early 60s, said that as a result of working with Roland Hazard and countless other alcoholics, that he's come to believe that the alcoholic's thirst for alcohol isn't really a thirst for alcohol. He said he believed it was a low-level thirst of the alcoholic's being for a connection with God and a union with God. And he also went on to say that this is an unrecognized thirst and a misinterpreted thirst. And it's because of that, it leads us down continually to the road to perdition. This yearning, this thirst inside of me has driven me. It's driven me to inappropriate sex. It's driven me to inappropriate use of money. It's driven me to drugs. It's driven me to alcohol. Drunk and sober. The yearning for gratification and aggrandizement and security has driven me. And yet, what Jung said was right, because I've never once in my life, after maybe being sober 6 months and on my way into a liquor store to get the first bottle with that sense of urgency for relief, and I've never once stopped on my way in there and thought to myself, this is a low-level thirst for God. Wouldn't even occur to me. And yet, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you surrender and you put all your chips in the pot here and you start doing this process of self-reduction in order to make you smaller and God bigger so you can eventually connect with this thing, or it will connect with you. You don't have to find God. He's not lost. You just have to get rid of a lot of you first. And as we do this, we start to realize that the thirst is diminishing. The more I grow spiritually, the less thirsty I become. In 1978, I back up a little bit. 1977, I ended up in an emergency room in a hospital again, and I hurt myself sometimes, you know. This particular time, I put my fist in an alcoholic, drunken rage through a plate glass window. I'd have stitches. It wouldn't stop bleeding. People felt sorry for me. They took me in this hospital emergency room, and they stitched me up, and did some x-rays. So I'm sitting there in the waiting room of the hospital, waiting for the results of the x-ray. Now, I've been in there about 2 hours or more, and there's no bar in an emergency room waiting room. I'm telling you, if there's ever a place they need one in there. There's no bar. So I've been forced slowly to sober up from a lack of alcohol, right? So I'm sitting in this waiting room, and there's a rack of medical pamphlets there, you know, diabetes, heart disease, that kind of thing. There's one that got my attention. It was the 7 warning signs of cancer. Now, I don't know why that one got my attention, but it did. I grabbed it off the rack. I started thumbing through it. And one of the things it said in there that was a warning sign of cancer was unexplained intermittent bleeding. I remember reading that. And sometimes in the morning, I would dry heave and there'd be blood coming out of the toilet. Matter of fact, on one or two occasions, I was bleeding out both ends. I thought, oh my God, I have terminal cancer. Oh my God. Oh no, wait, whoa, whoa. Oh my God, it's metastasized in my brain. I have a brain tumor. And all of a sudden, my whole life made sense. That's why I do weird things and don't remember them. I have a brain tumor. That's why I emotionally go off the deep end and snap at people for no reason at all. I have a brain tumor. That's why I can't hold relationships or jobs. I have a brain tumor. Oh my God, and I just started on this several month wine, man, where I'm just sitting there drinking that cheap wine, thinking about the brain tumor. Sometimes I can feel it growing. And you know what I think about is I think about one of these days, they're going to find out that I have terminally ill with a brain tumor, and they're going to take me to a hospital, I suppose, and put me in some cancer ward, I guess. And of course, they're going to have to notify my mother and father, who will have nothing to do with me because they think I'm a bum, and they're going to realize I had a brain tumor. And they're going to come running to the hospital, begging my forgiveness. And then all my ex-girlfriends will be notified. And they all thought I was a bum. And they're going to come running to the hospital begging my forgiveness. I love that fantasy. Well, not too long later, I ended up another detox. I'm telling this medical guy who's checking my vitals and everything, I said, he started talking about alcohols. I said, Doc, I have a brain tumor. And he looks at me, he says, has that been verified? I said, yes, it has. It's been verified by the smartest guy on the planet, me, right? And so he got kind of angry stuff about it. He set me up for a whole bunch of tests. They shot dye in me, they put me in a tube, they did blood work, they did all this stuff. And I'm waiting for my redemption. When they're going to come in and say, Bobby, you have a short time to live. You have a brain tumor. Everybody's going to feel, everybody's going to know how wrong they've been about me. I don't care if I'm going to be dead. At least I'll be right. And he calls me in and he said, we got your test back. He said, you don't have a brain tumor. You don't have any cancer at all. You have a small ulcer and a hemorrhoid. Great, you're going to live. And I wanted a second opinion. Right? And if you identify with that at all, you're in trouble, because I'm so sick and my ego is so big that I would rather die and be right than to be free and alive. But that doctor said something to me, and I remembered it. He said, kid, what you have is alcoholism. And you keep drinking, it's going to kill you. He said, but you're a young kid, you're in your 20, you're young. He said, you bounce back physically pretty quick. He said, it might take 5 more years. And somewhere I filed that away. Sometime in that next year, I ended up getting thrown out of a treatment center that I was placed into by the courts in lieu of 2 years in prison, and now the 2 years is going to come at me. And I'm sitting in a park, and I don't know how long I've been drinking, I don't know, it's a fog. But I can't get drunk right anymore. And I haven't been able to for a while. I think isn't that the worst thing that this disease does to you? After it burns your life to the ground and there's no apparent redemption, and you're finally hopeless, and you're so full of shame and depression and loneliness, when you need the freedom and the effect and ease and comfort from the drink the most, it ain't there no more for you. It's gone. And you can't get it back. And not from a lack of trying. I spent the last couple of years of my drinking desperate to jumpstart a party that's been dead for about 3 years. but I always had hope. You get me 6 months sober with restless, irritable, and discontent, low-level depression, and the loneliness of untreated alcoholism, and I will start fantasizing that I can get back to that old effect. And I'll play the game of Let's Bet Your Life. And I'll put everything on the line to chase an effect that I will not be able to achieve. Which makes this pathetic. Last year or so, my drinking was not a party. I didn't bathe anymore because I don't care. I drank, and sometimes I cried when I drank because I hated how I felt, and I hated what I'd become, and I hated what I did to the people I loved, and I felt hopeless. The loneliness and depression were so extreme within me that sometimes I'd get on 3-4 in the morning, I'd get on the telephone and I'd call people up. I remember one time I called an ex-girlfriend up, and when she answered the phone, I started crying into the phone, "We should have got married." Her husband gets on the phone and threatens. What happened to all my hip, slick, and cool? They got up and went. And I can't recapture any of the good days anymore. And I finally know it. And I came to in that park and I knew something I did not want to know. I can drink that stuff till it kills me. But I will never, ever get free again. And when I knew that, I didn't see any reason to continue to live. I made a decision to kill myself. And in making the decision, I actually felt better. Like I'm going to get this over with, you know? I'm tired. I'm in my mid-20s and I feel like an 80-year-old burnout wino. I'm worn out, man. I'm worn out. And I went to this bridge to kill myself. And I went there because I remembered what the doctor said. 5 more years. Jesus, 5 more years. I can't even imagine 5 more weeks. I'm done here. And I want to make it all stop. And I went to this bridge to kill myself. And I'm standing on this bridge, looking down below me to on these railroad tracks underneath the bridge along the river. And I got this fear hit me. It was not a fear of dying, truly. The fear was that maybe this isn't high enough. Mm-hmm. Maybe with my luck, I won't die. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be in a lot of pain and end up laying paralyzed from the neck down in some charity ward. I'll lay there for 50 years. And no one will bring me a drink, and I'll lay there and my head will be on me, replaying my shame and my failure and my remorse and the guilt over and over, and now I'm paralyzed, I can't even kill myself. And that frightened me. I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of that. There had been a plaque on that bridge that said 100% of the people jump from this spot are dead. I'm in. But I was so afraid of screwing it up. And little did I know, I'd end up off that bridge running from the law with another guy that had been in the treatment center, and we were hitchhiking. We're trying to go to California. Because I thought maybe if I got to California, they wouldn't find me. California's warm. I almost froze to death on the streets of the northeast part of the U.S. in wintertime. When you have no place to live, it's tough on those streets. Because you've got to walk all night long. You can't even sit down when it's well below freezing. So I thought if I get to California, maybe I could survive. Maybe they wouldn't find me. Maybe I could have a new life. Maybe I could get some phony ID. Maybe I could have a chance out there. And I never made it to California because by the time I'm almost there rolling through Las Vegas, I was so physically sick. They say it's only a small percentage of alcoholics actually become physically addicted to alcohol. And I was one of those guys. And on a long run, when I'm drinking around the clock, I get to a place where if I don't get a certain amount of alcohol in me, the withdrawal symptoms are extreme. The problem is, by the time I get to that place, my body will not hold the alcohol anymore. And I can get a half gallon of wine and throw 90% of it up as I'm trying to keep enough of it down to quiet my nerves and put the madness in bay. And I'm at that place where I can't keep it down no more. And that is a horrible place to be at. When you feel like you're dying and you're losing it here, you're coming apart at the seams, and you need the effect of alcohol, but your body's just saying, enough, I ain't doing this no more. And every ounce you pour down, it just throws it back up again. And through the help of a cop and some, I got put into a detox in Las Vegas, Nevada. It was August 28th, 1978. It's not my sobriety date because I was on some medication and various things for, I don't know, several weeks, I guess. So I picked the October 31st, 1978. And in that detox, something happened to me. And I didn't understand it for quite some time. But I sat there. Now, you can understand, I sat in probably 150 AAs by this time, in county jails, in missions, in hope, in Salvation Armies, in treatment centers, in detoxes, in halfway houses. But I could never hear you because I'm too full of me. Alcoholism is the most defended disease. There's probably people in this room right now that are dying inside themselves, and yet you're defending yourself and defending yourself and explaining yourself and justifying yourself and rationalizing yourself because this disease called alcoholism has the greatest survival mechanisms of any entity in the universe. And I'm dying of this disease. I fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell him much. There's a great psychiatrist in the East Coast, Dr. Abe Torsky. And Torsky cornered, I was in three places where he lectured. He cornered me after the third time. He said some things to me that really hit me. He said, guys like you don't get better. He said, some of you may find a way to exist in abstinence for decades, but you never change. And it's almost like purgatory. He said, you never get any better. And the reason you don't get any better is even though you truly have no self-esteem, and I don't know how he knew that, you've grown this gigantic defensive ego. And because of that, you're incapable of hearing anything new from anybody. You're only capable of listening to see how you are already right. And in my mind, I thought, he's just a stupid old guy. I'll tell you something. That was the most accurate diagnosis anyone had ever given me of me. See, there's too much of me in the way of you. There's no God in my life. There's no people in my life. You can't help me because I'm too full of myself. And this is an ego-driven disease. The book refers to it as the bondage of self. And I stopped drinking and I just got this thing that gets up on me. And you can't help me. Because I could be the most pathetic person in the room who can't stay sober, and I'm relapsing myself to death and hurting and emotionally gutting everybody I care about in the process. And I'm ruining my life, and yet I sit in the room and I'm smarter than everybody else. And I won't listen to nobody. Because I'm all of that. And after this failed suicide attempt, something happened to me. And I'm in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in that treatment center. And for the first time in 7 years of being around AA, 7 years of relapsing, for the first time, I guess I had enough of me kicked out of me that I could finally hear you. And your experience washed over me. And I sat there and I started nodding my head. And I started thinking, my God, I'm like these people. And yet they came in there, my first sponsor and some other guys came in there twice a week. And I'm connected with them. And I know that I'm like them, and yet something's happened to them, and I'm not like them today. that today something's happened to them, because I watched them. They laughed more than anybody. They laughed as much as I laughed when I was a kid smoking pot. I mean, they laughed all. They laughed at stuff I don't even know what's funny, but they're laughing all the time. They're happy all the time. They're successful. They have these big, these huge, robust lives. And they seem to be very concerned with helping others. And it seems to give them some kind of joy that I don't understand, because I don't care about anybody except me. But they had something, and I'm dying here. And I dared to hope. I dared to hope that, is it possible that if I asked for their help, and I followed them around, and I did everything they suggested and everything they did, is it possible that whatever this thing is that's happened to them, that when now they're happy, sober, is it possible that could happen to me? I was afraid to believe it, because I tried medications, I tried some great psychiatrists, I was in therapy with guys you had to be a movie star to see because of my mom, and no human power could help me. I mean, I've been in therapy with these guys that have been, wrote books and started psychiatric movements like Ellis and rational emotive therapy. And if these guys can't help me, why do I think some carpenter in an AA meeting or some, you know, clothing salesman or some cab driver is going to help me? But you get to a place, if you're really, really lucky, that Kris Kristofferson talked about in a song he wrote that was sang by Janis Joplin called Bobby McGee. And he says in there, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And sometimes you get to a place that talks about in our book where you don't believe in God, you don't believe in AA, you don't believe in nothing except that you believe in the hopelessness and futility of your life as you have been living it. And then it says, if that's the case, now when you're approached by those in whom evidently the problem has been solved, it says there's nothing left. No more plans, no more hope, no more new meds, no more new girlfriend, no more new city, no more. There's nothing left except to pick up this simple kit of spiritual tools that the people in AA have been laying at my feet for 7 years, and I'm jumping over it because I'm smarter than they are. And I'm dying of alcoholism. There very may well be people in this room that will be dead before the year's up. And it may look like you died of suicide. It may look like you died of a drug overdose. It may look like you drank yourself to death, but I know something different. You died from self-reliance. You die because you're killing yourself and you can't stop having your hands on the wheel of your ship, even though the evidence is overwhelming that me running my life is running it into the rocks over and over and over again. When I was brand new, there was a guy named Joe. Joe cornered me after a meeting and he said to me, he said, you need to do this third step. I looked at the third step on the wall, all the steps in there. I said to Joe, I can't do the third step. He said, why not? I said, Joe, I don't believe in God. I mean, they got my sponsors got making me pray, but I don't believe in God. He said, you don't have to believe in God to take step three. I said, well, look at this. This came to believe step two. Guys, you understand me. Step three, I don't have any of that. He said, listen, kid, turn your will and your life over to this chair. You put into a chair in the meeting room. So I guarantee you an instant miracle. I thought, okay, what the hell? All right, Joe, I turn my will and my life over to this stupid chair. He said, the miracle is your life's no longer in the hands of the idiot. Boy, isn't that right? Are you awake enough to see that your life has been in the hands of an idiot? Are you still determined and egocentric enough to want to keep justifying you and justifying your actions and explaining them and defending them and rationalizing them? Do you want to be free or do you want to be right? Pick one. Some people go, oh, can it be both? Most of us have made ourselves miserable trying to be both. And I started in this process of recovery, you know, going through the steps, and I started to develop a relationship with a God I didn't even believe in, because you had me take the actions of someone who was willing to believe. And one of my favorite lines in We Agnostics is that God does not make hard terms with those who seek Him. From the moment I started to pray and take the actions of someone who was willing to believe, even though I didn't believe, some crap started happening in the universe. It was funny. These coincidences started happening. It was as if I was getting lucky. You know, how many hundreds of times do you have to have a problem and you got no answer in it? You feel horrible. And you go to some meeting and a stranger's talking about exactly what's going on with you. Who the hell's the choreographer for that? And that happens to you over and over and over and over again. And guys like me start, even though I am God-resistant, I start to come to believe. And you had me start to enter into this process. It starts with step three and this vital and crucial decision that will become the basis of my whole life. A decision that I cannot carry out, no matter how much I want to. And so I start this process of self-reduction in step four. To start looking to see how wrong I've been about my mother and father, and my sister, and my exes, and the bosses. And it's a process of self-reduction. We don't grow spiritually by acquisition, we grow spiritually by self-diminishment. As I get smaller, you get closer. As I get smaller, God gets more present in my life. Because the problem all along is I got too much of me between me and you and too much of me between me and God. And they had me to start making amends. My sponsor, if I knew about the book what I know today, I could argue with him back then. He had me turn myself into the courts and my PO and offer to go to prison when I was like 6 weeks sober. If I didn't know what I know today, I could have said, hey, I'm not on step nine yet. Not that it would have made a difference. You know how you have a good sponsor? They don't care what you think. They don't care what you feel. My sponsor is wonderful. He doesn't even care how I feel. Every once in a while, he'll indulge me. He'll turn on his uh-huh machine. But I'll tell you something. He is very, very focused on what I do. Because it's only what I do that makes the difference. It's not how I feel. Feelings are erroneous. Feelings are created by your enemy inside. I got this ego that puts me into bondage, and the only way it can control me is it has to worry and scare me. And if you run your life on how you feel, you're running your life on aspects of your ego. My ego's terrified that it won't have a problem to solve. That's why, you ever notice, maybe you're like me, did you ever notice yourself finding problems where they don't exist? Maybe even trying to solve them, you know, run little scenarios. I think I'm going to problem this guy, so I'll probably say this, and then I'll say that. I'm continually trying to solve problems that haven't occurred yet. I'm always trying to clear up the wreckage of my future. Because that's my ego scaring me and worrying me back into the driver's seat again. Because it's terrified. If it doesn't have something to play God about, it's going to recede into nothingness and obscurity. So that's why when Wilson says in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, we talk a lot about problems. And he says, why? He says, that's because we are problem people. I got the mind of a chronic alcoholic. It does threat assessments, period. It's like a problem-seeking missile. It just, to this day, how many of you walk into a room full of strangers and just see the good in them? I walk in and I just start noticing crap. I notice the people, I walked in here earlier, I noticed the people that, I bet you bet you that guy's going to judge me. I notice the potential problems because my ego has to be in charge and it has to be defending me and protecting me and scaring me, or else it has no credence. And the book says, what do we do? It says, we're on a different basis. Remember that third step decision? A different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. Mm-hmm. And for the last 40 years of my life, almost, that's been the battle. Mm-hmm. It's been to take the actions of someone who trusts God, mm-hmm. no matter how I feel and no matter what my head says to me. It's easy to talk about faith and trust in God, but to live it every single day, if you have the problematic mind I have, is a lot of work. It takes a lot of practice. And the last 10 to 15 years of my life have been possibly the best I've ever had. I think it took me 25 years or better here of practicing trusting God before I started getting some traction in it. I mean, really, no, don't get me wrong, I would talk like I trusted God way before that. You know, because that's the psychotic wishful thinking of the alcoholic. I want the bragging rights of a guy who trusts God, but I'm a worrier. And it started to get traction. I've never felt more safe and protected and secure as I do today. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the promises in step 10, and this means a lot to me, it says that as a result of all this, we'll be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. And I guess they're talking about alcohol, but I'll tell you what it also means to me. That I am placed in a position of safe and protected from the chatterer, the negotiator in my head, the thing inside me that can scare me enough that I'll negotiate my own moral compass because I feel like I'm empty and I need and I want. What happens is the negotiator gets placed in neutral. When you're in neutral, you can rev the car all you want. You're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And what that feels like, and it's what the experience of it is, it's like your head becomes like music in an elevator or a doctor's office. It's chattering. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't engage me and it doesn't drive me because I'm in a position of neutrality. But if it can scare me enough, it'll get right here. Mm-hmm. And I'll no longer be in neutral. And my ego exists to have its way with me, to get me to play God again. I have a great life today in Alcoholics Anonymous. I sponsor a ton of guys, not because I'm a good guy. I just have to do that to just be constant. And I always get to have a couple new guys, because a lot of guys I sponsor, it's over 30, 35 years, they sponsor people, they're very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. Their ability to relieve me of the bondage of self is minuscule. I need crazy new people that are running around like Chicken Little and the sky is falling. Those are the guys that no matter what's going on in my life, I'll get so caught up in their drama, I forget myself. And as Dr. Paul used to say all the time, he says, isn't it amazing how our perceived problems will die of neglect while we're out helping others. Alcoholics Anonymous is an altruistic movement. It's not a self-help program. Mm-hmm. We have a primary purpose here above everything else, and it's not ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it's not money, it's not property, it's not prestige. Mm-hmm. Our primary number one purpose, even above ourselves, is that we've been saved in order to save. Mm-hmm. I've been helped in order to help. We all receive help here. And in order to keep it, you give it away. If you ever walk down the street and you see a telephone pole, and on the top of the telephone pole is sitting a turtle, you can know one thing for sure. That turtle has some help.
And so am I.
Thanks.
That was Bob Dee here in Christchurch, New Zealand in 2018, talking about the disease of alcoholism. So if you've related to anything that you've heard or would like some more information about Alcoholics Anonymous, you can look us up on the web at www.aa.org.nz or call us on 0800 AA Works. There are 66 meetings a week in Canterbury, so there's likely one near you. Join us next week to hear from more AA members sharing their experiences. Our show airs every Monday at 6 p.m. on Plains FM and repeats on Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. You can find podcasts of all our past shows on the Plains FM website at plainsfm.org.nz, and you can also download shows on iTunes. That brings us to the end of the show. Thank you for listening, and remember, if you want to drink, that's your business, but if you want to stop, we can help. You don't have to do it alone. We will now close the show with a serenity prayer all together, as we do in every AA meeting.
God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
You've been listening to the Alcoholics Anonymous radio show on Plains FM 96.9.
Wasted and wounded, it ain't what the moon did. God, would I pay? Stasis are soaking wet. A two-go waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you go waltzing Matilda with me. Now the dogs are barking and the taxi cab's parking. A lot they can do for me. I begged you to stab me. You tore my shirt open, and I'm down on my knees tonight. Old Bushmills, I staggered. You buried the dagger. You're still Matilda with me. Now I lost my St. Christopher, now that I've kissed her, and the one-armed bandit knows. And the maverick Chinaman and the cold-blooded signs, and the girls down by shows go. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you go waltzing Matilda with me. No, I don't want your sympathy, fugitive say. That the streets aren't for dreaming now. Manslaughter. magnets and the ghosts that sell memories. They want a piece of the action anyhow. Go, old Saint Matilda, old Saint Matilda, you. Go, old Saint Matilda, with me. And you can ask any sailor, and the keys from the jailer, and the old man in wheelchairs know that Matilda's the defendant. She killed about 100, and she follows wherever you may go. Old Saint Matilda, sing Matilda, you. Go, old sing Matilda, with me. And it's a battered old suitcase to a hotel someplace, and a wound that will never heal. No prima donna, perfume is on an old shirt that is stained with blood and whiskey. And good night to the street sweepers, the night watchmen, flame keepers. And good night, Matilda.